Now let's hear our third speaker, Stephen Jeffrey, and then we'll have a little stretch break before we get down to the Q&A part of the discussion and then our afternoon tea break. Stephen has worked with Suncorp since moving to Brisbane from New Zealand in November 2009. He became executive manager of the home insurance portfolio in February 2010 and in that role oversees the home portfolio and product functions for the various Suncorp brands. Now, he being from New Zealand, he's a proud All Black supporter, although he may seek Australian citizenship should they not win this year's World Cup. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come along and talk about flood pricing in the insurance context. Initially, I did think I was going to talk about some of the technical aspects of flood pricing, and then I realised I haven't done a technical job for a few years, so I thought I'd better not embarrass myself. So I'm actually going to talk about the top 10 challenges of flood pricing as I see them. I suppose the word challenges brings with it some negative connotations, and I'm certainly not suggesting that offering flood and pricing for it is not worth it, but I think there are some realities to offering flood cover, and hopefully this gives you some idea around some of the challenges that need to be overcome. So I'll just quickly run through the top 10. Some of this stuff has been covered by previous speakers, in which case I will I'll skip over it. So perhaps not surprisingly, the first challenge that comes to mind is around data, and there's been lots of discussion around data and flood mapping and availability and so forth, so I won't go into that in too much more detail. But just to sort of, I guess, reinforce that there are other aspects of data which can be challenging. And so some of the questions that we need to answer to offer flood are around how often will it flood and to what height, which is clearly in the flood mapping domain. If there is a flood, how much damage is there going to be? So some aspect of the damage curve. And then information around the property itself. Where is it located? What's its elevation? And what's it made of? Those types of property data. And each of those have their own challenges. The flood mapping challenges have been well discussed already, and I'll touch on that briefly on the next slide. In terms of damage curves, I suppose you need some historic data to be able to do the damage curve assessment. In other words, what proportion of the sum insured may be put at risk for heights of various levels. And I do know from my experience in New Zealand that often Australian insurers took some interest in looking at New Zealand flood experience to try and assess that risk or that element of the risk. In terms of the address data, obviously that's pretty key to get that right. And with the large frontline distribution forces we have, we often get that wrong, and there are historical challenges around that. And that's something that we need to continue to work on, and the property data falls into that category as well. And I'll cover a bit more around some of the particular challenges around the property data shortly. I suppose to bring that all together, though, the key challenge from a data point of view is the fact that relatively small changes in data can have quite significant changes in the price that's offered. And as the data is changing, as Carl's alluded to, over time, then that's something that we've got to try and explain. And the consistency and timeliness of data is pretty key and very difficult to attain. Now, Carl has kind of covered a lot of this, but this is a sort of a breakdown of the addresses and the coverage between the NFID data and the addresses that aren't covered by NFID. So I won't go that in too much more detail other than to reiterate Carl's point, which is clearly it's better than it has been in the past, and that's gives us an opportunity to offer flood. And secondly, the 52% or so which are covered by the NFID are clearly more concentrated in some of the areas with significant flood exposure. I suppose the challenge from an insurance point of view is we actually need to offer flood cover to 100% of properties. So wherever there are green bars there, we need to offer a price. So we need to find an alternative way to fill in the gaps, if you like. And clearly Queensland is one area there that's got a larger gap. So that's the data challenges. The second one is around the fact that the flood risk is not static. And I suppose by that I mean it's not that it changes a lot, like some of the working perils, but there are elements of the flood risk which do change over time, and perhaps it changes more than some people might think. And there are a few different influences on that. Firstly, clearly the climate has an influence around that, and I'm sure everyone's aware of the El Niño, La Niña trade-off there. Those two maps there show a La Niña year in 1998 and an El Niño year in 2002, 2003. Blue is wet and red is dry, so you can see that there's a pretty strong difference between the likelihood of flooding in those two scenarios. There are also some other climate influences, the Indian Ocean Dipole and the Pacific Decadal Oscillations, which are all about the sort of warmth of water at various places. And it was quite well publicised in Queensland in particular that leading up to storm season, we sort of had the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean working together against us, I suppose, in a way, from a flooding perspective. And that subsequently came true. In terms of other influences, there's been some discussion this morning around the effect of urbanisation, and this is a quote that came out of the ICA Hydrology Panel, their report around the Toowoomba event. I suppose the key thing that was of interest there is the last sentence: urbanisation has significantly changed the pre-development drainage characteristics of the particular catchment. So as there's more concrete, there's less stuff, less ability for water to drain away, and that will clearly change the risk. Once again, there's been discussion this morning around the impact of dams and levees and how they may or may not operate. And I suppose in the example of Wivenhoe, prior to the flooding event, we had to make an assumption around the effectiveness of that, and that will clearly be something that will be reassessed over time. And I'll touch on a levee example later on. And there's also the individual property changes that take place over time. So for example, consumers or customers who may raise their buildings because they're aware of the flood risk, and then also this thing that's become quite familiar to me in the 18 months I've lived in Brisbane of taking Queenslanders and filling in the underground level, which I suspect was there for more than just airing the property and may have been a good risk mitigation strategy. Third challenge is that the pricing analysis is complex. And I'm happy to say that I don't look after the pricing analysis. I'm just a recipient of it. So I'm thankful that we have a lot of people in our organisation who are capable of doing that. But the question is, why is the pricing analysis so complex? The first three bullet points there effectively cover off some of the stuff I've already talked about from a data perspective. The fourth bullet point, so we're going to need to pull together a variety of different risk models, given that not all of it can come out of the NFID data, and there are varying levels of predictability from those various models, and so that can cause us problems when we're trying to merge them together, particularly in a given catchment. We need to also formulate an overall view on the aggregate risk, so what's an average year of flooding in Australia, and I'm pretty clear that there's a wide range of views around that. And then thirdly, in terms of pricing analysis, I suppose as a portfolio manager, I'm constantly keen to understand what this is going to do for the wider portfolio in total. So some of the more general views around how customers respond to price changes clearly won't apply when you're talking about some of the price increases that may come through as a result of flood analysis. So the pricing analysis is complex and does require a lot of investment over time, and thankfully that's been something that Suncorp has invested in. So if understanding the individual risk is quite hard for all those reasons, I think it's fair to say that when you start bringing in the accumulation risk or the sort of the net risk to an insurer, it becomes even more complicated. And I've sort of tried to highlight this through a very, very trivial example, which thankfully my assistant has done a graphic design course, so she was able to pull these little pictures together. Consider two sort of remarkably similar-looking catchment areas where there is a mixture of risk at three different levels. So low risk at the top, and then medium and high risk, and probably some questionable land planning approaches, I'd suggest. And let's assume that there are two insurers on the left-hand side. Let's assume that yellow has all the medium and high risks, and the brown insurer only has the one low risk. And on the other side, there's sort of a mixture at medium and high. And the brown insurer still has the low risk. I suppose the question that comes to mind is, what's the net risk of insuring the house that's low risk? On the left-hand side, if the flood was to get to that level, clearly that's going to be Brown's first claim. Whereas on the right-hand side, in this particular trivial example, the brown house is the last house to be flooded, and so therefore arguably their last claim. So if we make the assumption that for a flood to hit the brown house on the right-hand side, it would trigger the brown's catastrophe program, then arguably there's no net marginal risk from the brown property in the sense that the reinsurers will pick up that tab. And so therefore, compared to the left-hand side where there's no reinsurance recovery, I guess the question is, do the reinsurers adequately charge us for the risk that they are taking on in the right-hand side? Or perhaps in other words, if Brown decided to take that low-risk policy out of their portfolio on the right-hand side, would the reinsurance premium go down? And so therefore, I would hypothesise that the net risk of insuring the brown house probably depends on how many of the other houses below that brown house you also insure. I say probably because it obviously depends on a whole lot of assumptions and how reinsurance is priced. This sort of gets a little bit more confusing when you consider that potentially there are two catchments where the river systems may or may not be correlated with respect to flood. And I'd suggest that the Brisbane and Bremer rivers are a clear example of where that may be the case, and history seems to suggest that. So if they are perfectly correlated, then the net risk of insuring this house is the same as the net risk of insuring the brown house at the top of the right hill, in the sense that if the water gets to that high, then the brown houses on the right-hand side will also be hit. If there's no correlation between the flooding of the two river systems, then clearly we're back to the example on the previous slide. So obviously these are very, very trivialised examples, but I would suggest that the net risk of insuring this house probably depends on the correlation of the flooding events in those two rivers. And I don't particularly want to get into the assumptions that have gone into this. It's really just to highlight the example that it's not just about understanding the individual flood risk. There is the accumulated risk as well, which is important. So all of this sort of comes together, I suppose, in a large job of ongoing maintenance of flood prices. And there are two key factors that need to go into pricing flood properly and in a targeted way. Firstly is around pricing at the property address level, and the second is being able to separately identify the cost of the flood peril. So both of those obviously require a significant amount of data in terms of supporting the addressing system, and then a rating engine that can separately identify the flood premium and price for it. As has been alluded to a few times, the input data changes frequently, and address data is one example. NFID data is clearly another example. So it's a good thing that it gets updated frequently, but it does cause some challenges from an ongoing maintenance point of view. And then the third point is, pesky portfolio managers like myself who, once the data has changed, want to know what is the impact to the portfolio and not just put it in and see what happens. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done around impact analysis and how the portfolio is migrated when the data and the view of the risk changes. And sort of further to that point is balancing the business objectives. So from an overall portfolio perspective, there are obviously a lot of positives around offering flood insurance and particularly following an event like we've just recently had. However, it can be tricky to balance the various conflicting business objectives. So here are just a few examples. Firstly, what's the impact on growth? And I would hypothesise that there's a different answer to that now than there was 6 months ago when flood perhaps wasn't top of the agenda in terms of the public debate. Secondly, there is a challenge around pricing for the long term versus performance in the short term. And as an example there, I mean, leading up to the storm event, as I said previously, we were aware that it was a La Nina year, very strong La Nina. There was the press around the negative Indian Ocean dipole. I think the view is we've now moved into a wet Pacific decadal oscillation, which is sort of a similar phenomenon to La Nina, but over a much longer scale, and that tends to strengthen the effect of La Nina. And so the question is, should we have priced for that in advance of the storm season? In other words, do we want our prices to go up and down every year depending on the likelihood of floods or bushfires happening? And thirdly, I mean, obviously customers own cars too, and we need to consider that. It's not just about home insurance. Yeah. Okay, sure. Thirdly, we need to we need to empower frontline staff to explain the flood prices, and that's complex because the complexity of pricing, and that different customers will have different circumstances. But we've made a call to have the difficult conversation at sales time rather than at claims time. Helping the understanding of flood, which is a key issue, I suppose, and has sort of come out to play subsequent to the events. So in October last year, we actually launched a website, a flood facts website, which had some information, and here are some screenshots associated with that. and we were launching that to try and support some of the interest in flood leading up to the storm season. The unfortunate thing is it probably came too late, and this shows the site visits to that website, which show a clear spike 2 days before the flood event, and that was about the same time as there were headlines along the lines of worse than 74 and so forth. Because we get it wrong sometimes, we do want to encourage and manage feedback from customers and other stakeholders, and that can be a delicate balance between having confidence in our ability to price the risk, but not arrogance. And I have an example here of the Gundawindi levee, which in one of our updates we didn't quite get right from a pricing point of view, and got the due feedback from customers and local politicians around that. And so we revised our pricing view around that, and we were pretty happy to see that the levy did actually hold despite that headline that said it could break. The last challenge is around affordability, which has obviously been a key topic, and something that I would suggest is not something that the insurance industry can deal with on its own. I think this is just some information from the Insurance Actuaries of Australia Working Group. And you know, clearly the premiums at that end are going to be pretty high from a private insurance point of view. And then just lastly, this is a quote that came at a presentation I was at a couple of weeks ago, which I thought sort of highlighted the issue quite well and was reasonably insightful, and perhaps hadn't been shown enough respect over the last 30 years or so. Thank you.